Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. You can enjoy, because this is the secret podcast, they are re-siding the house next door, so there may be some yelling and banging.
I've heard those stories. Starting very early in the morning, I hear.
Oh, my God. Fortunately, this morning it was raining at 7 or so they didn't start for like an hour, which was really nice. Yeah, that was nice. So they're supposedly done today, too, so that's even better.
Well, I have two. There are two cats around me right now. So anything could happen. They could fight. They could meow.
They could meow in harmony.
They could do nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
Unclear. It's kind of like a chess game, too. One of our cats, it's cat talk here. Hello. One of our cats is kind of territorial. And so she does a lot of sitting. It's like a chess game, basically, is what I'm saying. Is she will sit down. This happened yesterday where my dog was up on our couch and the cat was down next to the coffee table, kind of diagonal from where the dog was. And then the dog wanted to get down and the dog was like, "Where do I go?" And I said, "Aha, she's got you in check now." It's like, You have no good moves, dog. You just better stay there because that cat's going to come and get you.
The only way to win is not to play.
I agree. That's a good way to do it. That's a movie reference there. So
it is.
People who don't know. It's from The Hunt for Red October. Nope.
That's right. One ping only.
The only way to ping is not to ping.
Yeah, that's right.
Funny week this week. The public betas of iOS and iPadOS last week. Quieter week this week in a lot of ways. I didn't write a lot of stuff publicly this week. I've been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff for these projects that I'm working on that are... Well, I mean, there's unannounced projects, and then there's also that I've been writing the My Big Sur thing for whenever the public beta happens. So I was looking at the, as I often do before we do this podcast, looking at what we posted on the site this week, and it's not a lot this week, this quiet week.
Also, I think both you and I think both took the week off from our Macworld columns.
Yes.
So.
Yep, that was nice. I was happy to do
nice.
That.
I had to write my column for next week yesterday. Because that's now the schedule I'm on, which is still writing on Thursday, but doesn't post till Monday. And that one sneak preview is about Apple's relationship with Google and the things in iOS and macOS that's doing that are kind of either direct or indirect competitions with Google.
I think
it's always
interesting
to look at their relationship, right? Because like Apple, you know, it's funny. Just taking a step back from it, I was thinking about the fact that when you get these companies that are this huge, like Amazon and Microsoft and Apple and Google, they all exist in this weird space, right, where they are so big and there's so few of them at the top that they are not only competitors in some ways, but they're kind of forced into being allies in many ways.
Right.
Because you can't get anything done, right? Like so many of these initiatives where it's like Apple teams up with Google to do this. It's like, well, yeah, because you can't get anything done if only one of them like wants to do it, and it needs to be something. I'm thinking everything from like contact tracing to security, like all this stuff, you need to have buy-in from these big companies. So they're kind of forced to be in these uneasy relationships with each other where it's like we kind of make stuff that competes, but also at the same time, we kind of use different elements of each other's work in order to help our own work. Yeah. So, yeah, it's an interesting situation.
Apple still makes a lot of money from Google search referrals, too. You know, that's the default and all that. And it's one of those things where I'm sure they've had conversations about should they switch or probably buy like DuckDuckGo or something. And the answer is, why would we spend money on a search engine when a
we
search
paid,
engine
yeah.
pays us?
And it's the search engine that's still the de facto,
yes,
right?
The
like,
standard.
You know, yeah. So it's hard to move away from that for sure. It's a weird deal. I mean, like, it's the same thing. I think it's interesting always to look back at the history. You know, there are arguably three major competitors to Apple in the, you know, its first couple decades. And those were IBM, which eventually just left any business it really competes with Apple in, and eventually became a pretty big Apple partner for a lot of its enterprise stuff. You got Microsoft, which at Apple's lowest point infused a bunch of cash into the company because, you know, propping up Apple's platform was good for Microsoft's business. And you've got Intel, which Apple made into a partner, right? So like in weird ways, all of those companies that used to be giant rivals, like especially ones that Apple fans like defined themselves by their opposition to some of those companies, right? Like you're an Apple fan, like, I hate Microsoft, right? Like Windows, terrible, blah. Like it turns out that they ended up having these uneasy alliances with all of these companies because there's just, it's so symbiotic when you get to that level.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, the Apple-Microsoft relationship alone is fascinating.
So weird. So weird.
The fact that, well, I mean, you look at it, Microsoft brought its stuff to the Mac, like built Mac versions of their apps. Microsoft built a big chunk of the Office business on the Mac because they built those apps for the Mac first.
Yep.
And then they essentially got adapted for Windows. And so, you know, the history, and then the script flipped in the 90s and they started, you know, trying to make the Mac versions just the Windows versions, which then they got pushback, and then they kind of recommitted, and there was the investment from, you know, from Bill Gates in 1997 when Steve Jobs came back, which was sort of like perceived at the time as being Microsoft didn't want to be, was fighting antitrust on many fronts, and having Apple as a competitor, even though they're funding their competitor, was like good for Microsoft. But I think also, if you read some stories about that era, like Bill Gates always had a soft spot for Apple. He was always kind of like impressed that Apple did what it did, and that he couldn't ever quite, you know, not only could he not quite replicate it, but his business was not built around some of the, he couldn't afford to do what Apple would do, but he kind of admired it. And that's, I mean, my first cover story for Mac User was the browser war, where I picked Microsoft's Internet Explorer as a better browser than Netscape Navigator, which makes me feel like I'm a million years old now. But let me tell you, Mac fans in the 90s were not interested in hearing, were not happy to hear that a Microsoft product was good. Like they were really angry with me about that. And it's like, it was way better. And then,
eventually at one point it was the only option too, right? Like then, in the OS X transition.
It was the default. They made it the default as part of the deal in 97. That was actually kind of a validation for me, having said it was the best one in 95. That by the time we got to 97, Apple had made it the default browser on the Mac. And it was only, you know, but eventually Steve Jobs is like, we got to write our own browser. We can't depend. And Microsoft's browser got older and slower because it wasn't their focus, and that the focus is so much about it. But anyway, that relationship is kind of fraught, and you know, but then you look at modern Microsoft, and like modern Microsoft under Satya Nadella, like they want to be on all the platforms, and Office is not a way to sell Windows. It's Office is a platform unto itself,
it's
that needs
product
to be everywhere, and they want to be, and they're doing a good job being on like iOS and stuff like that. Although I still complain about the fact, I did this on Upgrade this week, that like their updates, I get why it is, but their updates are so slow. Like they just did multi-window support on the iPad fairly recently. They have committed to doing cursor support, but it's not going to be there until like the fall. So they're slow, but they're there and they're pretty good. So yeah, that relationship specifically, and like IBM, it has essentially become not an issue, right? That's the other fascinating thing about it. They used to be kind of frenemies, and now they're just partners, and that's really kind of it. Like it's just not that big a deal.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, again, the relationship from the perspective of somebody who's down in like the user area, right? Like we all were, versus the relationship of the people at those companies, or the relationships of the people at the tops of those companies. Those are all different gradations, right? Like you would think, you know, I remember being a teenager in the 90s and, you know, arguing, you know, Macs versus Windows, and you think like, oh, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates must hate each other. And it's like, I mean, I think that's probably overstating the case. I think they had a fractious relationship for sure at times, but I don't think they hated each other. And again, when you get to that level of like, you know, the sort of rarefied atmosphere of being at that high a level in the industry, you kind of know everybody and you kind of have to get along, as much as Steve Jobs had to get along with anyone. You kind of have to get along with them.
Who out there in the world is like you in any way? Like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, ultimately, as they got older, had
closer than they were different. Yeah.
Yeah. They had more in common, and remembered the old days, and were in a position where they're famous and rich and running these big companies and all that. Like they had a lot of things in common. I knew in the 90s a lot of people who worked at Microsoft who were Mac people. So like the tidbits connection there was strong. Like I knew through Adam and Tanya Engst, who lived in Seattle then. Tanya actually worked at Microsoft. She wrote, and the connection was really strong. Like, she wrote a book about Microsoft Word for Mac. And that was the thing you could do back then. That was a big deal. And she also then worked at Microsoft doing support. And Jeff Duncan was doing QA. And there were a bunch of other people in that kind of circle who I met who were working. But they were working on Mac stuff at Microsoft. And then there was a huge Mac group in the Bay Area who worked for Microsoft. And that was sort of like the Mac business unit headquarters ultimately. So like that, even there you look at it at a big scale and you're like, oh, Microsoft. But like, there was a long period of time when the bits that we would always quote were, Microsoft makes more money for every Mac sold than every PC sold. And because of the prevalence of Office on the Mac. And Microsoft was the biggest Mac developer outside of Cupertino.
Right.
So like, even then it wasn't really true, but yet, you know, and as a user, yeah, you get really involved in those kind of wars over like your friends saying that you're dumb for using a Mac and they've got this awesome PC and all that. And, you know, to this day, the truth is, to this day, John Siracusa won't buy an Xbox. He won't. He will not have a Microsoft.
I know. I'm well aware.
Product in his well house. Aware. It's amazing.
I find it very amusing to
that
me.
Man can hold a grudge.
I've owned Xboxes for years. It's like I've used Microsoft software, and you know, I've probably had some other Microsoft hardware and other random little things here and there. But yeah, I don't know. I remember the appeal of feeling like you are part of something and wanting, especially when you were the underdog, right?
Yeah.
Like that's a powerful Kool-Aid there. And I liked the community that fostered around it, but the older you get, I also feel like the more you're like, they're big companies and none of them love me, right? Like,
yeah.
I feel no loyalty or obligation to a company that is not really looking out for me.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's what I always said. One of my lines, every now and then I come up with a line that I like so much that I keep reusing it. Like when I talk about cable, like cord cutting, and I say they're always going to get their money, which is totally proven right. But that was one, which was, Apple is not a charity.
Yeah.
Is one that I use a lot. Or Apple is not a nonprofit. Apple is not a, you know, whatever you think Apple is. Because a lot of times people be like, it's an outrage. Why does Apple charge this? Or why is Apple doing this? And the answer is to make money because they're a corporation. Yeah. They have shareholders. And, you know, Apple might be, you know, might style itself as a benevolent, more benevolent corporation that's got some beliefs and they believe in leaving the world a better place. And that's all great. You know, because there are many corporations that don't believe that at all. But at the end of the day, they still want to make money. They're like, corporations are machines designed to make profit and these days shareholder value. And it is that too. And that's always in these latter days where Apple is in a position of power, which is, for those of us who remember when Apple was doomed, is a very uncomfortable thing in a way. It's great in the sense that they could like have a series of misfires and they have so much cash that they're going to keep running for 30 years anyway. But it's not great in the sense that you lose that underdog kind of feel. It feels a little bit weird. And yet a lot of people still act like Apple is the underdog. And the place where we see it a lot is whenever anyone criticizes anything Apple does, there is this whoosh of people who run and try to defend Apple and protect Apple and suppress criticism of Apple. And that I would argue is largely a thing honed in the period where it felt like everybody was beating up on Apple and nobody understood them. And they were being mistreated and they were about to go out of business. But today, it feels much more like, stand back, everyone. I must defend the honor of the world's most powerful and rich company. And no one needs to defend their honor. They can pay people to do that.
It's like if you were volunteering, you know, if like somebody was suing some rich celebrity and you volunteered to be their public defender. And it's like, no, that's not good for anyone. That's not good for you. That's not good for them. Like, it doesn't actually help anybody. Yeah, it is funny, but I think you're right. It comes born of that long period in which like it was really about an identity thing more than anything else. But yeah, it has changed a lot in recent years, and Apple may be better than some. You know, as far as those things go, it has the virtue of having products which the way that they make their money tends to not be as problematic as maybe some other companies. That said, they have their own huge share of challenges, including just like things like the environmental toll of making their products. And they have made a lot of time, spent a lot of time and energy on trying to improve that, not only because it is a good thing for the world, but it's good for them, right? Like, PR is money, right? Good PR is money at the end of the day, because it makes people feel good about you and makes people more willing to spend money on you. So that's, you know, it's not altruistic. Let's put it that way.
There's a clear, speaking of quotes that I come back to, I had an Apple PR exec tell me at one point, in straight up terms, and she said it in a way that was, we were just having a conversation about like how we do what we do, and it was a really good, a lot of my conversations with Apple PR are very transactional, but sometimes you get them to open up a little bit. And in this one, she said, "My job is sales," right? Mm-hmm. And that's the truth of it. Like, it's not my job is not sales. Her job is sales, right? Like, that's just how it is. And you got to read it that way. And they spend a lot of money on that. And it's PR. PR is what it is. I don't know. I don't know how we got on to Apple being an enormous company, but there it is, and it is weird. And this project that I'm working on has me looking back at the past and various incarnations of Apple over the years. And that's also, it's fascinating to remember the different eras of Apple, because there's the early to mid 90s era, which is when I started covering Apple, and they're just so weird, like wasting money on bizarre projects and desperately flailing to try to find their way. And there are clones, and there's like QuickTime 3 VR and
CyberDog, OpenDoc,
all this stuff, and Taligent, and like there's so many things in the 90s that they did. There's like, what are you doing? And then I was looking at a clip the other day. There's also late 90s, early 2000s Apple, which, because, you know, this may shock some people to hear, but like Steve Jobs didn't come back to Apple and flip the "we're now successful" switch, and then they were magically successful. There's a good 5, 6, 7 year period in there, maybe even longer, where Apple, it might even be a 10-year period between Jobs' return and the release of the iPhone, where Apple is still scrambling, but they're scrambling in a way that is guided by Jobs. But they're still kind of flailing and trying a bunch of stuff because he's trying to save them from oblivion and get them on a new path. And a bunch of brilliant stuff happens in that era that changes Apple's fortunes, including the iMac G3 and the iPod eventually.
And the transition to Mac OS X too, which happens right around there too.
Which is part and parcel of Jobs' return, right? Like Jobs was literally a throw-in. I was looking, sorry for the sports tangent, but there was a trade in baseball yesterday that was mystifying all the baseball writers I follow on Twitter, because it was literally like a really good player for an okay player, and then the team that was getting the okay player also threw in another really good player, and people are like, why did you do that? And I was thinking, this is like, all right, we're buying Next. We get Next Step. We've got our new operating system. Oh, we get Steve Jobs too. Okay. All right.
And an executive to be named later.
But anyway, I was watching the launch of the XServe, which I think I was at.
Oh, yeah.
It's a town hall. I think I found my notes for it, actually. And Tim Cook's in there, back when he was, the boring guy who was in charge of operations. It's like Tim Cook, John Rubenstein, and Phil Schiller with Jobs in the Q&A at the end. And what's funny about it is, first off, it is the least sexy, and I don't like using that word, but I'm going to use it here, the least sexy Steve Jobs keynote ever, because it is just super boring. It's about servers. It's about enterprise. But that was a moment where Apple's like, we're gonna try for the enterprise. Now that we got a Unix server, we can do that. And it's hilarious, because not only did it not work, I mean, the XServe stuck around for a little while, but it was never really much of anything. And the way Jobs frames is like, we're very humble. We're coming into this. We got a lot to learn, but we're committed. And I'm sitting there going, not that committed.
Where are you?
But it's just a good example of, first off, the you know, mythology that builds up about, like, well, Jobs came back and everything was saved. And it's like, no, they were still trying a lot of stuff.
It took a while.
Some of it didn't stick to the wall. And it was really the iPhone becoming wildly popular that kind of clinched it. The iPod gave it the rocket fuel it needed, and then the iPhone pushed it over the top. But those early, you know, first 5 years of Jobs there, there's a lot of flailing there too. So that's kind of funny. Apple's gone through a lot of stages, and now they're in, you know, Titan stage, which given that the iPhone is basically an annuity, like, people upgrade their iPhones, even if they don't do it, even if it's flat or even down a little bit, like, the iPhone will be throwing off billions of dollars for a very long time for Apple.
Sure.
So they're just in this new weird state now where they have to kind of deal with success and not let it I think culturally they're not going to do this, but it would be very easy to just build your business around the iPhone and say Apple is a company that makes money from the iPhone until there are no longer smartphones, and then we'll go out of business. And, you know, Jobs is going to, you know, his culture is what pushes them to this day to not do that. But that's their challenge now, but not back then. Like, back then they were still trying to find their way.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, and always, like, with some of these companies, you know, technology as an industry is fairly young as a sort of, you know, consumer industry. And Apple is one of the longest living corporations, you know, over 40 years old. And it's you can't, as IBM showed, you can't last 40 years and stay the same company. It just, the technology moves too fast, right? Like, it's, you have to adapt. And it's, so it doesn't surprise me at all that it's been through all these different stuff. I mean, it's the volatility and the wideness of the swings are kind of what make Apple so interesting, compared to some other companies. But yeah, you know, almost every decade, right? Like, you know, you kind of look at the, you know, going from 77 to 87, 97, Jobs comes back, 2007, they put out the iPhone. I don't know, something good happened in 2017. I don't remember that long back anymore.
I don't know.
But, you know, every 10 to 15 years, you got to kind of roll with things and figure out where do you go from here. Because even if you can sit on that pile of iPhones, and you can because it's a giant pile of iPhones,
ouch.
Sooner or later.
Well, they're curved. Yeah. In fact, and this is the behind the scenes that people who are listening to the Six Colors podcast have come to expect. I've just written down life stages / eras of Apple / Macworld in my story list for a future Macworld column, because I feel like I could get 800 words about that easy. So
sure,
I'm always looking for those columns.
You gotta stay looking
for the ones that are like of a certain kind. Oh, we speaking of which, we are now on our weekly members only post schedule.
That's right.
Weekly-ish.
Weekly. We're easing in.
Yeah. Yeah. So Stephen Hackett did one last week, and then you're doing one sometime here.
Yeah. I mean, before the end of the week.
Okay. Well, it's Friday.
I know.
Afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll get done.
That's fine. We made a calendar now. It's all very official. So that's a Six Colors thing that we're doing. That's going to adapt, but I think it's going to be fun. And then my idea there is that the back page, your humorous column that was at the end of the newsletter, is also going to be the thing that posts basically at the end of the month.
Yeah, bringing the month to a close.
Maybe even on the last day of the month every time. I don't know, but
we'll
something
rename
like
it
that.
The last day. How
the
about
last
that?
We can say. Oh no, that's too scary, Dan. Is this
the
is
last
this
day
it?
Before tomorrow? No, we got. It's only the 17th. We got like 2 weeks.
All right, that's a relief. Anything else going on? Anything going on?
Yeah, Twitter.
Oh yeah. Well, you know,
what a weird week. I did enjoy. So they also. I'm curious about this. Somebody posted this, I think, in the member Slack, but Twitter rolled out also a new API update. Which people were discussing whether or not this would be like, you know, finally Twitter is once again, you know, supporting these third-party apps. But I, you know, reading through their blog post about it, it strikes me that I wonder just whether or not this will actually mean anything for the development of specifically third-party Twitter clients.
Right.
Because they are talking a lot about academics who want to use Twitter and enterprise that wants to leverage Twitter for stuff, but they're not really talking about small app developers who want to write apps that are basically Twitter clients and compete with Twitter's own Twitter client. And those people have become increasingly disenchanted with it because, obviously, it's gotten much, much harder for them to make their living based on those things. So I was kind of waiting to see if Craig Hockenberry had weighed in on it.
He may specifically not want to, right?
Also possible, sure.
Well, Twitterific is an interesting state because my understanding, and who knows how long this will last, but my understanding is that they are they're kind of like a favored nation with Twitter because they use... You know, basically Twitter adapted so much from what Twitterific did that they kind of like give them a special pass. It's also the reason I think that they're the only app that's allowed to use the word Twitter in their name, third party app, because they, you know, invented so much of Twitter.
I've gotten frustrated a little bit because I'm still a Tweetbot user. And definitely there are some places where Tweetbot feels like it has not gotten a lot of love recently, yeah. And there are some issues.
I mean, that's the downside of these things not being, you know, widely popular is that I feel that way with Twitterific too. In fact, I felt bad because I was being mean to them a little bit, but I was also just being critical of them, and it's a product and I use it all the time, so I was complaining about Twitterific on Upgrade on Monday. But like, they have two separate contextual menus for different stuff. It's so frustrating, like, that you can't, you know, there's an ellipsis menu per tweet that it brings up like an old, like iPhone, very old style list of buttons. And then there's also a tap and hold and wait that brings up a different contextual menu, and they are not the same. And it's just, it's little stuff like that. They are actively working on it. I get betas from them. But yeah, it would be nice if this new Twitter API enabled some of these specialty third party apps to be better, and that Twitter, because, you know, the longtime argument is most people are going to use the Twitter app or the website. It's not that big a deal, but why not let the people who have, you know, their power users or their, you know, the people who care more about Twitter, give them access? Like, it definitely degrades my Twitter experience that I can't see polls. A lot of stuff I have to like tap and hold and open it in a web browser in order to see what's going on and what the context is. The refresh rate where you can only refresh every 5 minutes. That's a restriction they added to their API. Like, all of this stuff that basically degrades the quality of the clients. It would be great if they got, you know, if they truly are getting some religion about like clients and third party API access being okay. But like you, I'm skeptical that what they view as a new Twitter API is not for any of the ways that we use it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds good, like what the message that Twitter is spinning there sounds good, but I'm just not convinced that it's aligned with what Twitter wants.
Right, man. Right. It sounds like they're doing a good new API refresh.
Which is good, because for years there have been things that Twitter clients, third-party clients can't do, right? Like, I think of things...
But it might not be for us, and it might not be for them.
Right,
so
exactly.
Don't get too excited, because the details may be disappointing.
Tempered optimism, which is the only way I have optimism in the world anymore. Tempered.
Yeah. So, let's see. Before we go, I wanted to... let people know about a membership thing, which is I'm building up the back archive of all the stuff that used to be in the newsletter, and I haven't put links to it in the member page on the website, but I will do that today. But if you go to sixcolors.com/category/member, you will get a page with all the stuff that's in the database anyway, so far, of all of the stuff that used to be in the newsletter that's now also on the website. And I'll put links as I go. I think I've gotten back to the beginning of 2019, so I've got a couple more years worth of articles to post. But it's really fun to see those on the web and not just locked in a newsletter. And we're working on some other stuff in the background the WordPress system. I've got a bunch of tags in there, which we're not surfacing now, but I'm actually talking to our designer, Krista, about surfacing those tags, which would be kind of nice so that you can just write on a post, see like, oh, this is a post about Big Sur, and click and see all the posts on Big Sur and stuff like that, which is, you know, but it's blog 101, but I kind of like never surfaced that with the site design, and it would be kind of useful now. But anyway, I'm still doing some cleanup work on the site, although the site's performing pretty well, I think. After a month or so of doing this, like, it works. I found, what was it? Some post that I wrote a long time ago got passed around again this week. It was the post about, it was a link post, and it was about the story about finding the black hole imagery.
Oh yeah. I saw that in the stats go way up, and I was like, what's happening here?
And it was like, it got passed around on I think it was on Reddit, and it's an old post, but somebody found it and thought it was fun, and other people thought it was fun. It is fun, but it was also old. My point being that what I like about that is that's an old link, and it just worked, right? Like, that was part of the point. Was I moved house for Six Colors, and I didn't want things to break, and a few things broke, some images broke, but mostly not, but a few things did. The newsletter images kind of broke, but most of it didn't, and that was a good bit of proof that link is from ages ago, and it still works, and it serves exactly what it was supposed to, and it looks like it's supposed to, and that made me happy, because that was the goal of all this, and now I can kind of, you know, I wanted it to be as you know, I want to minimize disruption for the readers, and then be able to kind of like build on that. And we did have a beautiful moment. I don't know if I talked about that here, but we had a beautiful moment a week or two ago where one of the other benefits of WordPress came out, which is you were noticing that if you're not logged in and you look at one of the members only posts, it was all like smashed, like the images disappear and it gets smashed down into one big paragraph.
Right.
And you, with your back page column, especially, you know, you often have like a short sentence, and then you follow it up and it all gets mashed together and you lose the style of it. And I was like, oh yeah, well, this is because I'm using the summary field, and the summary field that WordPress does strips out all the HTML. And how do I, and I was like, all right, Dan, I'm going to put it on my list. I'm going to figure out how I can take the full text and then truncate that. And then came that moment where I realized that there's a WordPress. I just searched for a WordPress plugin. I actually was searching for, how do you do this? How do you make a rich excerpt in WordPress? And the first hit in the Google result was a plugin that does rich excerpts. And I was like, oh, install.
It's
activate.
The best thing about WordPress is that there is a plugin for everything.
Yeah. It's funny because I think the one thing that we've talked about doing, there's not a plugin for, which is, so we post our podcast appearances, right, on Clockwise and The Rebound and Upgrade. We post those manually to Six Colors as, here's a podcast appearance. What we would like to do is find a WordPress plugin, ideally, and point it at the RSS feeds for those podcasts and say, when a new item goes in the feed,
so post. I think there actually is, and I can say this because we've been working over at The Rebound on our membership program there, and you helped Lex and I a little bit with that. And one of the things I discovered is that Lex had found a system for importing posts from an RSS feed.
That system, the word system there sounds terrifying.
well, it's a plugin. It's a plugin that does it. But the reason it's a system is because right now that setup is kind of bananas, in that there may be like, I think there's like 2.5 WordPress blogs serving it up, which is 1.5 too many
that's not ideal.
It's not ideal. Well, but there is a plugin for this.
This is where I was going to go with this, though, is that while there are many plugins that will kind of do this, they're all geared toward intellectual property theft. Essentially, there is a whole plugin market for WordPress that is point your WordPress blog at some other blog's RSS feed, and then take their RSS feed and post it on your blog. And as far as I can tell, it's basically for content farms. Although, you know, it's charitably described as being like, well, you know, links to other sites that you care about. And maybe there are blogs out there that we'll do that. That's not what I want to do, right? Like, our links are all curated and we write things about them and all that. But the podcast thing, I would like to automate. And so when I've been searching around, what I found is this kind of uninspiring thing, to the point where I was thinking we may end up having to commission a WordPress plugin to do exactly what we want it to do. But because it's not that there aren't plugins that do this stuff. It's just that they're all geared for a certain kind of experience that is not our experience. Because I had a moment where I was like, oh, this is where all those things come from, where people say, hey, did you know that there's a site pirating all your content? It's like, it's this plugin. That's what's doing it. So I don't know. We'll talk about what the Rebound is doing, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. Dan just sent me a secret message.
I sent you a link to it. To the one that we were using, which okay. actually is not bad. Right. But yeah, we'll figure it out.
But the horror of those of those content spamming RSS plugins.
Oh yeah, the worst. It is always fun to get your hands like elbow deep into some of these things, because it turns out that a lot of it is very customizable. I spent last weekend rewriting what should have seemed like a fairly simple thing, which was over on The Incomparable, where we have a setup where it's like, when we're live on YouTube, embed the YouTube video on our Incomparable live page. And also I had set up a little site that was essentially just doing redirects for when we were live. And it's like, oh, detecting that a YouTube channel is live, that should be easy.
Right.
And it turns out there's a big asterisk next to that, because I kept exceeding like the queries I could make against YouTube's API. And so I had to write like a rate limiting system, basically.
Yeah.
Which was in depth, but like, it's funny because the end result is essentially like, you only see this thing and all it does is like pop up, like it's totally transparent, right? The whole goal behind it, as we did when we did some alterations about the audio live stream over there, was just like, one less thing for us to do when the stream is live. It
right.
should just figure it out and do it,
right?
And that's like easy, right? Like it's the thing that looks too very transparent if you're going to that page, but it turns out behind the scenes, actually a fair amount of work.
Yeah, we actually, Greg Noss wrote a Python script that every 5 minutes or something looks at the live server and sees if it's on. And if it's on, it does some stuff. It sends some pings to like the member Slack for The Incomparable and stuff like that. And then your thing, it does some similar stuff. And it's like, you know, the beauty of it is we've now got it set up where when we go live, it's just live and we don't have to do anything. Where before we had to like flip a bunch of switches and stuff. Like a relay has to still do that now. So we're ahead of them there. They can give us a hard time about movable type, but haha. We have auto sensing live streams now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's held together with spit and baling wire, but yeah, it works.
Don't tell anybody that. Nobody knows. Just us. Just you and me. All right. Well, thank you to all for listening to this episode of the Six Colors Podcast and for supporting Six Colors. We appreciate you very much. And I believe we're on the new thing now. That's the other thing, right? It's like I posted the last episode to the old feed. So all of you, congratulations. You made it over here to the new feed. And now you get to stay here, because the old feed was security through obscurity, so I would just recycle the URL every couple of years. So we did a change at one point to the Hidan URL that we used to have.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just everybody gets their own. It's tied to your account. And it means that I can no longer have this thing where somebody subscribes for a month and subscribes to the podcast and gets it forever. Now it's just all tied to subscriptions. It's great. Super clean and easy. So thank you all for making your way over here. And until next week, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.